her and everyone else this Friday, starting at 4 p.m., Friday afternoon, at Dog Hammarskjöld Plaza at the United Nations 47th Street, between 1st and 2nd Avenues for Universal Peace Day, Friday, August 5th, 2011. And for more information, you can check the website, universalpeaceday.com. And we're so honored to have had Suzanne with us on this eve of decision and remembrance for both past, current, new, and future victims of the atomic disease on this planet Earth. That concludes tonight's program. My name is Robert Knight. I solicit and welcome your comments and suggestions and leaks and questions. You can email rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, rknight at wbai.org, or drop us a note at WBAI 120 Wall Street, New York 10005. And once more, it is we find insufficiency in being able to thank all of the listeners who have supported WBAI in our most recent fund drive, which made $530,000. You've been listening to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight. Keep listening. Jim Freund, Arthur Wolf coming up next.
Okay, fade out. That was not the segue. It was like, go from the end, love you make is equal to love you take, and, slow fade out, And then the howl.
Yes.
So are you going to sing it for me? What?
I know what you were thinking, but you know that in the
Zen tradition, I know what you're thinking,
no,
Jim, but in the Zen tradition, every great and true work of art does contain a flaw. I rest my case. We'll be right back.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, David Chandler, because it's a fantasy book, not a horror book. Otherwise, it would be David Wellington. Just trust me and stay tuned. Good morning. God, it feels like forever since I have been on, and in a way it has been. 3 weeks ago, when the fundraising drive started, Ken Gale was filling in for me, and I was at ReaderCon, one of the few conventions that I continue to go to since I found some sanity in my life, and, well, relative term there. And it was also fundraising drive. And then 2 weeks ago, I was scheduled to be on. I called and asked, should I come in? And the program director said, yeah, come in and pitch. So I was here at 1:30, and we apparently did transmitter maintenance and went off the air at 2. So I got to beg for money for half an hour, and well, we made Zip, which it may be a new number for me there. That's like, you know, as long as it takes to warm up, and just about the time where I got into it, we went off the air. And last week I was preempted. So this is like, welcome to the next series of Hour of the Wolf until the next fundraising drive, which will be next week. No, not quite. But they do come hot and heavy, because this is listener-sponsored radio, the real thing. At any rate, we have some very interesting, very fun shows between now and the next drive, which I think is October. And even during October, we have some magnificent events outside of the program coming up. I have to wear these headphones from across the way. Something is feeding back here, and I don't know what. It's these. Okay, pardon me. Testing 1, 2, 3. There we go. Okay. Next week, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which this morning's guest read for... When did you read for us at the South Street Seaport?
Gosh, I don't know the exact date. It was at least a year ago, maybe 2 years ago.
Well, maybe more.
More?
Had, oh, possibly. Yeah, we've been out of the Seaport for 2.5 years.
Well, then it's more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, because we're now at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. And Paul Witkover, now, I don't remember if he was my guest curator or if he was still the regular curator at that time. I think he was a guest.
I have no idea.
Yeah. So I would say about 3 or 4 years ago, actually.
Yeah, the last 6 years have gone by in such a blur.
This is before the Marvel Zombies, as I call it, came out. But after, was it Zombie Nation?
Monster Nation.
Monster Nation.
And then Monster Planet, which was the third one.
Okay, it was before Monster Planet.
Okay, so that would have been sometime in 2005, 2006.
Wow, okay, so 5 years or so.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
How time flies. Yes, Robert, you're looking consternated. Oh, okay. Oh, you're finalizing yourself. That's it. People, if you had a television to watch Robert Knight finalizing himself in the control room, it's a sticky issue. Anyway, we are now at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, and next week's readers will be Laura Ann Gilman and Keith DeCandido, or if you like, pardon me, Keith R.A. DeCandido, as he goes by professionally. But he's, around here, he's just Keith. And these are both really fun, entertaining, Yeah, there's a certain cerebral, but forget it. What both of these writers are simply thoroughly entertaining. And that's good enough reason to go. And Dave, and I'm sorry, do you prefer Dave, David? We haven't talked enough.
It doesn't matter to me. Most people who know me call me Dave. People who don't know me call me David.
Okay, very good. We'll use a combination. We'll start out with David and move towards Davehood by the end of the show.
As you get to know me.
Exactly. Basically that's it. You want to know more? Fine. You can go to my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. The view of the website is very much 90s, but I'm working on it. But nevertheless, you will find a link there to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and you can click on that. If you are on Facebook, you can find just type in those words, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. You can do that on Google and get there as well. And that will give you all the details. But basically, it's this coming Tuesday, August 9th. We'll open the doors at 6:30 p.m. Admission is free, but we will try to ask you to contribute to the dinner of those who are reading for us. And you can come with us to that dinner, in fact. That's a thing. And if you just want to go in and take a chance without looking it up, it's 138 Sullivan Street this Tuesday at 6:30.
Can I say something?
Please.
I have to say that dinner is probably one of the most fun things that any fan of this kind of writing could ever experience. Because you get to sit there with authors,
readers,
editors, people who know this stuff back and forth. It's not the most professional dinner, but it is some of the best stories you'll ever hear.
Yeah.
Some of the most funny stories you'll ever hear about this business, about this genre. And I love that.
Yeah, it is incredible fun to do that. We go to a pub nearby that I will not name on the air, but it's a pubby atmosphere and great for, raising an elbow. But if you just want to order water, you can raise your elbow with water, and they have good food at cheap prices. KGB Bar, after the fantastic fiction readings there, they also, when they go out, I compare what we do at the Nursef readings. Ours is more like performance. It's much more of a formal thing. KGB Bar is more like a salon, and that's where you get every third person is an editor. Or something like that. And that also is just an incredible amount of fun. both they both have very different feels, but they're all both also, as David said, within the genre and incredible fun to do. Some people show up just for the after event. That is true.
And the food's definitely better at the New York Science Fiction.
Oh, yeah, we got it all over them. Well, it depends on where we go, but yeah. A sad note, a two-time reader for us at the New York SIF readings, Leslie Banks, who wrote under her primary pseudonym was L.A. Banks, but whose real name was Leslie Esdale Banks, read for us last time last October. I had recorded an interview yet unaired. At that time, I have, she was at that, we were making plans, late winter for her to come on this program midsummer. But, she died Tuesday unexpectedly, or rather the expectation came about only about 3 months ago and was, pretty horrifying. She was 51 years old. And she had what was called a rare and virulent form of adrenal cancer. And whether or not you like this kind of how would you describe it? You're within that the horror genre. But she was writing, would you say, pop vampire novels? Is that a fair?
Sure. They were. You know, certainly, I don't want to mischaracterize it. They were light entertainment, sort of cozy vampire stories.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. And werewolves as well, of course, because sure. After your fourth or fifth vampire book, you got to get a, you know, you got to have a werewolf. You know, it's in the rule book.
It's inescapable.
And whatever you thought of her style or that kind of thing, she was one of the nicest, coolest, sweetest people that you would ever meet. And her reading, she wasn't a great reader or anything, but that didn't matter. She filled the space with audience, and they came because they knew that she would talk about how she became a writer, and she just had this enthusiasm for the field and for what she did and how lucky she considered herself, and being a ghetto kid from Philadelphia, this is a black woman we're talking about, who became a major best-selling writer, and how it was possible for her to do that. So it is with, you know, more shock at this point than sadness that I have to report her death. There were, in fact, scheduled for this week events to help offset the amazing and shocking financial needs that a freelance writer, bestseller or not, has to face when you're not working, you know, for a corporate company with all kinds of insurance. And those events are going to continue to take place, not only as memorials, but to help the family involved and all that. And for more information, go to Facebook. They're all listed there. And if you can't find that, send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com, and I will find whatever information and email back. Okay, that's announcement number two. Announcement number three on this program next week, Geek Wisdom. Steven Siegel, who is an editor and publisher, has put out a charming book of one-page stories. They're not even flash fiction. They're more like fiction. They come and go, and they're all just little bits of wisdom from geekdom. And he will come. We will have two of his writers on the phone and one or two of his writers here in person. On the phone will be, I don't know these people, so I hope I'm not doing anything bad to their name, Zaki Hassan. Zaki is Z-A-K-I. So I'm going to assume that Zaki, or Zaki, more like that one. Zaki, I think. Hassan, that's easy. And Eric San Juan. These are two people I do not know, but will be here on the phone. And then in person, definitely, Genevieve Valentine. who is just, you know, one of my favorite people, and so I can't mention that her novel Mécanique is available right now in all better forms of booksellers. And N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin. Oop, nope, she's not confirmed. But there's always the hope that if I mention it on the air, she'll show up. Except that I happen to know that she has to get up early every morning. It's difficult for her. She's already done, since we've moved to Wednesday nights, she's already done the show twice. Come on, Nora, three times. She's been getting nominated for Hugos and Nebulas, and it's not enough. She is just a wonderful writer and a wonderful person. But it doesn't matter. Come here for some geek wisdom next week on Hour of the Wolf. Wednesday night, Thursday morning from 1:30 to 3. Now let's do today's show. With us, David Chandler Wellington, correct?
That is my full name.
Indeed. And I tried unsuccessfully to get you on the program when we were 5 to 7 a.m., but that was not in the cards.
I am a nocturnal creature. The light of dawn actually harms my delicate skin.
Okay. So, but the 1:30 to 3 was more viable.
Yeah, I'm kidding. I'm a night owl by nature. I stay up till 4 o'clock every morning just because it's so much easier to write then. It's so much quieter, and so much just all the day's distractions are over with, and I can just focus. So the idea of coming to Wall Street at 5 o'clock in the morning was just. It was not
daunting.
Only daunting, it was unthinkable in the true sense of that word, in that I could not imagine a 5 o'clock in the morning.
After having done it since 1972, I am the master at seducing people onto the air and be, you know, it's like, you know, boiling a lobster, you know, and starting at, you know, the cold temperature, and before they know it, it's boiling, you know, before you know it, you're on the air. And I had not on the air at 5 a.m. anymore, but I had ways of getting people to, making it easy. One of them might be, oh, I'll meet you, you know, 11 p.m. in Chinatown. Before you know it, we'll be on the air. It works. I've done it more than once.
I think the real question, though, Tim, is how did you adapt? This has got to be a change for your schedule.
It is very, very different because I was very much even more of a night owl than you. I would just stay awake all night and be ready. There was a time when I would produce or engineer the Midnight Show. Uh-huh. And I would just be on the air in the control room from midnight on, do my own show at 5, and engineer the 7 to 9 a.m. show.
Wow.
This was when I literally lived, you know, my hippiedom, hippiedom at the radio station. And I adapted to that. As I started to age, I would take naps. Mm-hmm. I would go to sleep about, 10 or 11 o'clock and wake up at 1,
mm-hmm.
so that I could still be fresh on the air at 5. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to do, but the hour for broadcasting is magnificent. And the hour now is fun. It's a lot of fun, and being sandwiched between Robert Knight and Lister, you'll meet Lister when he comes in at 3. That's quite the experience.
Can't wait.
Oh, yeah. Believe me. It's a Rastafarian experience, and it's easier in a way because you just stay awake late.
Mm-hmm.
And I generally am not asleep until after 3 a.m., although listeners to this show might argue otherwise. So, no, it's actually very easy. Either way, and there are those regular guests of mine, like Rick Bowes and some people who say, oh, it's so great that you're on at 1:30. You know, all they have to do is just, you know, wander on in. And then they leave and they go to bed at their regular time. For me, it was the other was the harder way, but It has its attractions. Both slots are interesting. I miss my half hour, though. I'm only 90 minutes now. I was 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And I consider the ideal radio show. Everybody look at your microphones now. 3 hours.
Sure. No, I have a little experience in radio. When I was a teenager, I worked for WYEP.
A fine station.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I had to be taught how to say the call letters, W-Y-E-P.
Mm-hmm.
And
It's hard enough to get people to say W and not W.
Right. Eventually they said, well, you're just not going to be on the air anyway, so you can say it however you like. I was a technician for the Dr. Molnar, who was a Hungarian personality in Pittsburgh. There's a huge Hungarian population in Pittsburgh.
Was that really his name, Molnar?
Absolutely, Dr. Victor Molnar.
No relation to the playwright, I assume.
No. It could have been. I have no idea. The man terrified me. I never asked him a single question. He was enormously tall and just had a very great physical presence. And he was on for 3 hours every Saturday.
Mm.
And afternoon. I was... yes, in the afternoon.
I hope everybody is. I'm switching chairs, so don't mock me.
I guess I can tell this story. It's been long enough now. The trauma has started to fade. But the Hungarian music, there's a special kind of song called a csodás, which is a wonderful, lovely folk tune that goes on at a certain tempo for, say, a minute, 2 minutes, stops dead for about a second, and then launches into a coda at double the speed. And this coda, which only lasts about 10 seconds, is the most important part of the csodás, as any Hungarian musicologist will tell you. However, it had been drilled into me as a junior radio technician that the worst thing on heaven or earth, worse than nuclear war, worse than, you know... the return of Ronald Reagan to the presidency would have been even a moment.
Okay, for a horror writer, you just chilled me to the bone, but go on.
Exactly. It was even a moment of dead air. I would have been taught that if the host dropped dead of a heart attack, I should have a cart ready to slot and music ready to play. So these chodashes would happen.
I'm sorry, I'm just comparing that to here.
A minute, 2 minutes of this wonderful folk music, and then it would stop utterly dead. No sound whatsoever. My instinct that had been just drilled into me was hit the button, play the next song. Now, I would cut off the coda on every single chodash. Dr. Molnar would jump up and down in his booth. I couldn't hear him, but I could see his mouth moving, and I could see him screaming at me in rage, this enormous man. And he threatened to kill me a couple times, actually, I think. I eventually learned...
Turn you into goulash.
Not to... As long as he used plenty of paprika. But
yeah.
He...
Smoked.
I eventually learned... to play the entire chodás and not cut off the coda. And the day that I did, the day I finally got it absolutely right to his satisfaction, was the first time he ever mentioned me on the air. And he said, thank you very much to David, my booth technician, who made this show possible. And it's funny, it was, at the time, that felt like the highest praise I could receive.
Mm-hmm.
That this man had actually said thank you.
This is before you were a best-selling author.
It was before I was pretty much anything, but it was just, I think that it's a relative thing. I think that when you're used to abuse and anger and just vituperative rage, even the slightest acknowledgement of your existence and the possibility that that existence may continue is so welcome. That it just, my heart broke right then and there, and I just fell in love with Dr. Molnar and his Hungarian csodáses, and I love Hungarian folk music to this day.
I wish I'd done, maybe I can find some to play on the air.
Oh, I'll just we'll sit here with dead air, and you can go chase one of those down.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, it's frightfully easy to if I had a name, I could probably get it. But anyway, Who am us? Anyway, to quote the Firesign Theater, as David Wellington, you are pretty darn well known.
In certain circles.
In certain circles, yeah. But the circles that count, which are book buyers who enjoy entertaining monster fiction.
Right. Exactly. The circles that count.
Yeah. And how would you, mostly zombies, but also other creatures?
I will do any monster. I take requests. I did zombies, I did vampires, and I did werewolves.
Okay.
And plenty of short stories with other kinds of monsters, but the everybody keeps thinking of me as the zombie guy.
Yeah, that really did take.
It was my first book. It was my first published book. Was a zombie book.
The title.
The title was Monster Island. It is still available. You can probably still find it.
It's never been out of print, has it?
No, it's sold surprisingly well over the years.
Yeah.
I think people just love zombies. They really do. It's funny because at the time I had no idea.
Is it number two to vampires at this time? On the monster hit list?
The monster hit list, I'm the wrong person to ask. I think you need to go find a 13-year-old boy, a 15-year-old boy, and look at what is scrawled on the front of his composition notebook, assuming that 14-year-old, 15-year-old boys actually still have notebooks. I don't know. Maybe they just take their laptops to school.
Yeah, but a lot of these books are girls, you know? I mean, the Twilight phenomenon. They're
absolutely
alone. And a lot of the readers of Leslie Banks were teenage girls.
You know, one of the most encouraging things anyone ever said to me was I had a female fan, and that most of my fans are male. I won't lie. The boys and the men, the adult males, seem to enjoy the zombies a little more than women do on the whole. And there was a sort of consensual wisdom in the publishing world that my books were for boys and men and that girls and women would never buy them. So it wasn't worth pandering to them. It wasn't worth publishing to them.
Rumble, rumble.
And I got a few emails from female readers, and I was so happy to see that. I had originally intended this to be certainly for everybody. And put plenty of strong female characters in my stories with that in mind. And
but some marketeer had other ideas.
Absolutely. And so I was slotted into this sort of, arrested development, perpetual adolescent male category. And I started getting emails from female readers saying, why aren't you marketing to me?
Mm-hmm.
And it shocked me. It shocked me. I gotta say, if someone said, I would like to market something to you, I would like to sell you something, my immediate reaction is, let me get my shotgun. And yet, here are these women who were so desperate for someone to take them seriously and to treat them as human beings instead of numbers on a psychographic demographic chart.
Yeah, which are wrong to begin with because they're saying these people won't buy it and there's the clamor.
Absolutely. And so, to this day, I always think about those emails, these women who were willing to accept spam into their lives. They were willing to accept press releases sent directly to their homes as long as I would take
dogs
them seriously.
Dogs and cats in the streets.
And I've tried to write for everybody since then. I still get pigeonholed here and there, but I always try to put something in the book for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, by the way, that you managed to transcend the horror audience because, quite frankly and bluntly, as I point out, I am not a horror reader. I don't read something because it is horror. I will read horror often when it is presented to me. And occasionally, often enough, I find myself very pleasantly surprised at how much I'm enjoying some of it, especially monster fiction. But what I tend not to enjoy in horror, the stereotypical thing, is the visceral, describing how the arm is being chewed and all of this stuff. But I found in the first of your books that I read was Monster Nation. And it was like, okay, yeah, he's going to be performing for us at the Nearsif readings, and going to try and get him on the air. And I read, and I really enjoyed it. So it, so you're not only transcending the target market of, you know, the boys or whatever. I, as a non-horror reader, had a really good time and went on and read some of your other stuff. I haven't done any of the vampire books yet, but I've read any number of short stories when I can find them.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Jim. I will tell you a secret. This is my deepest, darkest secret that I've only told to everybody who asks.
Or that's okay. This listen. Is WBAI. Nobody's listening.
Yeah, no, so I tell the secret to anyone who asks or who will listen to me for more than 5 minutes, and it's my deepest, darkest secret. I didn't plan on being a horror writer. I grew up thinking I was going to be a science fiction writer.
Uh-huh.
It's what I read. It's what I loved as a child. I certainly read plenty of horror. I read Stephen King. I read, you know, Peter Straub and Clive Barker and all these things, and loved it just as much. I didn't differentiate back then, as I think most people didn't. I think in the 80s, well into the 90s, genre fans were just genre fans.
Yeah, exactly.
You picked up a book, and if it looked good, you read it.
And by the way, for listeners who don't know my show, when I say, I will say this is a science fiction show. It's not. It's genre. And if we don't do genre, fine. But you know, it's, I use the, what's classically called the Damon Knight definition of science fiction. Science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
It's what I enjoyed reading last night. Yes.
Yeah.
So I thought of myself as a science fiction writer, and the first zombie book was going to be a science fiction novel. It was about the future, after all. It was about, you know, a world full of various technologies. It just happened to have zombies in it, which I think was... It just came out of the fact that I had just moved to New York City and was dealing with the crowds, especially in the subway stations. Everywhere you went, there were 1,000 people trying to get through exactly where you were standing.
Yeah.
And you couldn't find a place where you could just stand and wait for it to all die down. Not that it was going to. You had to keep moving.
There's a quantum physics issue here.
Absolutely. There is no square foot of New York City real estate that is not, doesn't have somebody trying to get through it right now, even at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Especially
now. So it was this constant press of human bodies. And at that point, you're not looking at faces. You're not looking at personalities. These were just human forms who wanted something that I had. And so I started to think about zombies in those terms, because this is what I was experiencing every day. And so they got into the book, which was originally about an astronaut. There's no astronaut in the book now. I'm sure that any author can sympathize with me. I had a brilliant idea for a book. The book I wrote was completely different. In fact, it has no resemblance to the original book. It's still great, and you should buy a copy. Yeah, I know I'm marketing now. But
and we haven't even mentioned Den of Thieves, yeah, just out from Voyager.
That's David Chandler.
By David. Oh, that's that other guy. Yeah.
That's that other guy who's also here. He'll show up in a minute.
Yeah, he's using the same square foot of space as you are.
Anyway, so I wrote this science fiction novel that happened to have zombies in it, and suddenly I was a horror writer. Well, now, of course, as a science fiction writer growing up, that was a kind of weird transition. I had to learn how to scare people all of a sudden, you know, after my scary book had already come out. And it was a real education, but I had always wanted to write science fiction and fantasy. There's our segue.
Mm-hmm.
And horror and suspense and crime and thrillers and romance and who knows what, mysteries. Because growing up, the books were just so magical. Every single book I picked up was wonderful, and I wanted to do that. I wanted to just make another one of those. We're here tonight, I guess, to talk about David Chandler, who is my sort of...
We're here to talk about both, because I was going to have David Wellington on this program, except 5 a.m. turned out to be an unthinkable hour. But David Chandler came instead and brought Mr. Wellington along.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. But I will, before we talk to David Chandler, I will point out, though, you could still write that other book. It's a trunk novel now. It's, you know, you haven't written it, but since one thing morphed into another, as long as you start with that as your core, it's like cooking a stew. You know, you started out, it's going to be, you know, this kind of soup or stew, but it becomes that kind instead. And next time you can try the same one and it'll be something else again.
Which is exactly what I did with Den of Thieves.
Okay.
Another segue.
There's the segue.
Yes, it's,
Den
but it's
of
true.
Thieves from Voyager Books, part of Harper, you say.
Indeed.
Harper Collins or Harper? Just Harper Collins.
I don't know. They've changed their name a couple of times since I
signed. Well, Voyager used to be EOS Books.
Yes. It's.
And before that was Avon, right?
You know what? If you go on Amazon and type in David Chandler, you'll find it. If you go to your bookstore and you look on the shelf, you'll find it under David Chandler.
Okay.
And not that you should go to Amazon.
This is a paperback.
You could also go to Books a Million. You could go to IndieSense. You could go to Powell's Books. You could go to the Tattered Cover.
You can't go to Borders.
Sadly, no.
Almost
although
anywhere else, though.
Borders was selling the book for 10% off, but I don't know that it's still available.
Yeah, they might still. I mean, they may still be doing their online business.
So, to get back to actual content rather than marketing. So... we've been having some fun. My name is David Wellington. My name is David Chandler Wellington. Chandler is my middle name. I'm using David Chandler as my pseudonym for when I write fantasy novels. This was a decision that was made on a number of levels, basically so that nobody who picked up my fantasy novels and enjoyed them would accidentally pick up one of my horror novels and get scared.
Oh, I see. Okay. You see, you were telling this to me on the phone, but it didn't fully penetrate this thick brain. It wasn't... Okay, so you didn't want people to get scared by reading what already existed. So a new persona was born.
The David Wellington books are full of graphic violence.
Yeah.
They are full of people getting pulled to pieces and...
Dismemberment and all
horribly
the stuff I really
named
like.
And all kinds of things. And it's not for everybody. It's definitely... not for kids. It's not, well, I don't know. I was reading that stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah, right. Anybody who grew up in my era reading EC Comics or whatever that was.
Well, some of the most funny reader email I get is from kids, and I always worry at first, but then it turns out that their parents bought them the book and read it with them. I think that's just wonderful. I think my mom and I used to read books together and talk about them. And I think that was why I was able to read such horrible graphic stuff, evil, profane stuff at such an early age and turn out okay. Was just because my mom was there to help me through it. She was there to help me understand that this was fiction. It was not real. But sadly, not everybody's going to have somebody like that watching over them and monitoring what they're reading. And so I've written a book now that does not have any graphic dismemberment in it. There's certainly plenty of action and excitement and an adventure, but there's not a lot of blood in that book, and there's not a lot of gore. And if some 8-year-old picks it up and reads it and loves it, I would be very happy to hear from them.
I would call this classic fantasy, perhaps in the Fritz Leiber tradition. Is that fair?
I intended to write a pulp fantasy swords and sorcery book of the kind I used to find in Walden Books in 1983, filling the shelf and with the most incredible
covers.
That was
already post Fritz Leiber and all that.
Right. It's a little before
showing
my
age.
No, Leiber was a huge inspiration for this book, though, and I think anyone who reads it will see that immediately. But, you know, this is not just me copying previous generations either. This is certainly updated for the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
There are a million little things.
You know what it is? Partly the cowl on the cover of the book makes one think of some of the illustrations for The Grey Mouser.
Sure. Malden,
that has more to do with, you know, book covers than anything else.
Right. Malden, the main character of this book, and The Grey Mouser are not very similar characters, but they are of a similar profession, which is that they are thieves.
They're thieves, yeah.
Strangely enough, given the title of the book. But this is...
But good guy thieves.
Yeah, yeah, an extent.
Yeah, and well, that's a grand tradition in fantasy. You know, for those who don't remember, Bilbo Baggins was a thief.
Absolutely. He was hired as a burglar. That's what the dwarves needed.
Exactly.
Man, I gotta reread that book.
Yeah, do it before the movie.
Yeah,
so that you can retain absolutely a little of your mind's eye before before it all becomes Martin Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I like Martin Freeman, but, you know, that's not my mind's eye version of Bilbo.
You know, it's so true. As good as Andy Serkis was as Gollum in those movies, I can't remember what Gollum looks like.
Yeah.
From when I was a kid.
Yeah, I can. I had that burned in, and I produced my own radio version of The Council of Elrond, which includes a lot of the retelling when Gandalf is doing that telling. You know, in the movie it's 3 minutes long, but in the book by Tolkien read aloud, it's approximately 110 minutes. So...
Oh, but man, I promised myself I wouldn't talk about Tolkien. This is...
It's another show. You'll come back maybe.
Okay.
We'll record something.
Okay. This is, for people who don't know, that there was fantasy before Tolkien. There was, in fact, a long tradition of fantasy stories and novels before The Hobbit was written.
It needs to be pointed out that Tolkien was a scholar who was taking from all these traditions of the Upper Edda and the Nibelungen Lied and all of this stuff, and what his writings are almost, in a way, a brilliant compilation of old fantasy.
Traditional fantasy.
Traditional fantasy, brought into the 20th century.
Pre-printing press fantasy.
Yeah.
The stuff I'm talking about, though, is more the pulp era, the 20s, 30s.
Clark Ashton Smith. And...
Clark Ashton Smith was a huge influence on this book. So was Robert E. Howard, although you'll see that later in the third volume. This is a trilogy, although each book is going to stand alone. The really cool thing that we're doing with this trilogy is that all three books are going to get published before the end of 2011.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. I am so pleased when they do that. They did it with Naomi Novik's first series of books in the Temeraire series, and... I really, really love that. It's the, shall we call it, the anti-Michael Moorcock thing where you could wait 10 years for Moorcock to write a sequel, and then sometimes he didn't do it. And P.J. Farmer, Philip Jose Farmer, was worse.
And we've had some recent examples, which, while nobody's fault, have just been really tough on readers, especially readers of fantasy in the last decades, say. I'm trying not to name names, but because for some.
But you can send an email to me.
You can always send me an email. I answer all my email. You'll find it on my website. My current website is ancientblades.com.
That's plural blades.
Oh God, I'm marketing again. Anyway,
no, that was informational, and being on this show is we're chatting, but it's marketing.
Anyway, so all three books will come out before the end of the year.
Excellent.
And they do tell a continuous story, but each of them can be read on their own.
Including, like, novel three? Could you start with that?
You could indeed. I hope, because I know what happens in novel three, and I hope that you will, if you started there, you would be so compelled to go back and read the first two. But you could read it on its own. It really, each one tells a coherent, separate story.
Distinct,
which is a very conscious decision on my part. We talked about Fritz Lieber and the Grey Mouser and Fafhrd. And this harkens back to the short story era, the magazine era, when authors had no choice but to tell stories that were self-contained, because you didn't know if the reader was ever going to see another copy, another issue of that magazine. And so these are episodic stories, and yet they fit together as a mosaic, which is getting really pretentious now.
No, mosaic novels are in.
Okay.
Cage Baker, Rick Bose.
Just because they're in doesn't mean they're not pretentious. But the idea is the stories will all fit together, and you will get, you'll see these characters develop, you'll see these the plot lines change with each book. And so the second one, which is called A Thief in the Night, will be out in October, and then the third one, Honor Among Thieves, will be out in December.
Very good. And the box set for December? Make your own box.
Buy lots and lots of copies of my books, and we'll get box sets, and we'll get
and these covers. And this book is already also available in ebook, unless I'm mistaken.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They will all be available in ebook on all the usual platforms.
Yeah.
I want you to read this story. I'll make it as easy as possible on you.
Well, speaking of the short story and short story eras.
Indeed.
You have brought a story.
I have.
We don't have to do this. We don't have to do this because we're already past half gone with the show. We can just continue chatting and taking calls, or you can read.
You know, I could keep marketing all night.
I'm okay with that.
We could also talk about old books, which is one of my favorite things to do in the world.
Why don't we chat?
Let's chat.
You know what I'll do is at some other point I will ask you to record the story privately, and then it'll be in the can for me to broadcast at some point, or we'll make it the DVD extra for this show when it gets podcast.
Fair enough.
Okay. So for now, but I hope everybody out there enjoyed the story you just heard in the future, because you're hearing the podcast now. Old books, you say. You got here an hour before the show, and you were talking about books as fetish items, which is a fabulous phrase and something that I certainly enjoy books using the word fetish in its literal meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Something that there are fetish stones. It's almost like a talisman. People will have a stone and they can rub it and enjoy it and feel it has a very personal thing. Actually, if you think of, or rather not think of, the movie Inception, where each person has their object that they can identify as their own. Those are fetishes.
I think that what I
meant... Although they don't use the word.
When I talked about books as fetish objects, I meant the exact opposite of that.
Did you?
In that movie, those objects are there to remind people where the line between the real world and the other world is. If they had their objects to remind them what reality was. And I think the books as fetish objects are...
Remind you where fantasy lies.
Every book contains its own world. And that might sound a little corny, but it's so true. You pick up a book and start reading it. I don't care if it's a book about debutantes getting ready for their 16th birthday parties in New Jersey. This is a different world than the one you live in.
Mm-hmm.
It could, in fact, be a book about... a guy who has a radio show that comes on at 1:30 in the morning and he talks about science fiction books. It's still a different world than the one you live in, and that is magical. That is magic in a way that I have never found with any other physical object. When you pick up that book, if you enjoyed that book, if you lived in that book for a while, because that's what we do with books, we live inside them for a little while, you will be transported to that other world again, on a subconscious level, maybe a preconscious level, or maybe you will remember some scene from that book and you will smell the air and you'll see the ship.
Well, for me, that's the most magical, is with the things that I've enjoyed, it's the reread.
Absolutely.
Because the reread does exactly what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
It could bring back a piece of music that I was listening to the previous time that I was reading that book. It becomes a portal for me. I might remember a sandwich that I had that day, or might make me think of a smell and thereby evoke these various memories, or just bring me back to that same world, to that same place that I inhabited the first time I read that book.
Right.
And for me, that can be as true of a short story, which I'm, you know, a huge fan of short stories, but I can also appreciate let's call it the George Martin-sized immense, immersive fantasies. And I think that one of the things that George locked into there is that incredible voyage to, you know, that totally takes you within that other place. Robert Jordan is successful with that as well. Wasn't the prose. Couldn't be. But nevertheless, he had page turners that brought you to a specific place. And for a long time, to that world, which is, I would say, the greatest power of fantasy. For me, it doesn't have to be fantasy. Raymond Chandler brings me to a Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, never having been to the Philip Marlowe world, is as fantastic as a lot of fantasy fiction I have read.
Right. I think fantasy books, the fantasy genre, is the absolute best at doing this. This is the real point of fantasy books, of fantasy novels, is to do this, to create this other world. Certainly other genres do it as well. Science fiction can take you to other planets, literal other worlds. But those planets operate by the same physical laws as this one. They operate by the same scientific measures. You know, a horror novel will grip you emotionally, maybe, more than a fantasy novel can. It'll get into your stomach and make you dread what happens next, and it's a wonderful power that horror novels have.
I hosted a panel on this at ReaderCon with Charles Platt, if you can imagine. So he's the writer of very visceral things, and me, the squeamish one.
Yeah, that's the kind of that.
It was a great panel.
We horror writers love you guys because you're easy targets.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I have a writing group, and one of the readers can't do horror. She can't handle any kind of needles or knives in a story at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know if she actually read what I hand her, that it was good enough that she read it anyway, that she kept going,
yeah,
as scared as she was.
That's the key for me. Which is why I was giving your book's high praise, because I could read them, even though it sort of goes against the grain of what I will read. I will not do it with movies. Movies, you know, I have an option to simply not watch, or if needs be, on certain scenes of films that aren't all gore, I can simply avert.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course,
but horror, books are another story.
Horror movies are moving in a really kind of nasty direction the last 10 years. I have theories about that too, but we were talking about fantasy.
Yeah,
we could probably have this conversation for,
I tell you, 3 hours is the perfect length for a show of this type.
I could talk about this stuff all day. That's the thing.
Yeah,
I would be happy to continue this conversation for another 6 hours, but we just don't have the time.
No, we don't. And soon enough, we're gonna. If you want, we can open it up to listener calls.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk to listeners.
Yeah, but let's keep going for a couple of minutes here. And not forget mentioning the words Den of Thieves every 5 minutes, because that's the current book. And why we're talking about fantasy as opposed to horror, actually.
So I guess I'll finish my point by saying this is why I wanted to write a fantasy novel, why I've always wanted to write a fantasy novel. We talked earlier about the books you put aside, the ones you never wrote, but maybe one day you'll get back to. This was very much one of those. This is a book that my 13-year-old self would have written, although not as well, I hope. It's a book that I would have loved back in those days when I would do anything to get away from the boring suburb where I was growing up, which, you know, back then I just, any kind of other world was such a relief. It was a surcease of sorrow, a momentary respite from the terrible ennui that my teenage self felt. And so I devoured fantasy novels, couldn't get enough of them. And this is my tribute to those books, but it's also my attempt to do what they sought to do, to create that other world, a world with its own rules, a world impossible to reach from ours, except through this one particular medium of the printed word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The printed word is my second favorite mode of communications. The spoken word being radio. You know, it all started with storytelling.
Absolutely.
It all started with people around a fire and sitting on rocks. And then they found a way to record that, and that's the written word. And I don't think it's ever gotten better than that. You can adapt, but between the spoken word and the written word, that is the author communication to the reader. And there's a lot to be said for the visual media,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, as can be pointed out, I can do better special effects on this radio station in the next 5 minutes than George Lucas will ever be able to do.
That is true. I think that every medium has its own strong suit that it can play to. I think that there are things you, I will gainsay you and say that there are things that George Lucas can do that you can't do on radio, as hard as that is to believe.
Yes.
And I think that there are things that film does better than radio does, just as there are things that radio does better than film.
Yeah, our montages are not that good.
Right.
although even there, we have had producers on this station through the years, highly artistic people who have gone on to careers in film and otherwise, who have done amazing things in radio.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the reason I always mention George Lucas and the radio connection there is I'm quoting him. he you know, Skywalker Sound has a very, very important place for Lucas, and the sound in any Lucas film, even Howard the Duck, is always superb. He pays very special attention and is very, very well aware of the importance of the storytelling capability of sound. And to date, the only series of radio drama that National Public Radio ever broadcast was produced by George Lucas. So just for the record...
Well, George Lucas knew. I mean, he grew up with radio. He was probably the last great living director, who is old enough to remember a time before television at this point, in science fiction, maybe. But he remembered, you know, the beating of the giant chicken heart. He remembered the world's largest hot fudge sundae. These are all radio in jokes that no one is ever going to get.
No, actually, on this station, they will, mm-hmm. because we actually broadcast before Bill Cosby did that routine. We've played the actual one. Max Schmid does Golden Age of Radio here in WBAI.
Mm-hmm.
Twice a week, we do old-time radio on this station. Mm-hmm. And the Stan Freberg I play on this show regularly.
Yeah.
For you know, the plane dropping the maraschino cherry on top of the 10-ton hot fudge sundae. But anyway, so actually, yeah, that's the – and we actually made reference to that earlier on the air tonight when we were pitching for the – does anybody here remember radio? And you see, that's already the nostalgia. Some of us here remember the original of that.
Yeah.
So there is, and by the way, the Pacifica radio tradition goes back to 1948. So, just to not to gainsay the gainsay, but to defend ourselves.
No, I'll
we still
touché.
Do it here, and I'll be producing a radio drama next month.
Touché, sir. Well played.
Okay, thank you.
Let's get to those calls.
The telephone number here to speak to either David Wellington or David Chandler, you have a choice.
It's really the same guy.
Really? Depends on it's the left channel or the right. No, I'm not going to pan pot this. The same guy, the horror writer or the fantasy writer, or the future, who knows, science fiction writer, is 212-209-2900. And, of course, the rule of the evening, morning, is be on topic or you'll be off the air. Complete switchboard full of calls. Okay. Oh, you'll need your headphones, David. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Mr. Chandler.
Yes.
Dennis Thieves sounds very interesting. By the way, I'm glad to hear that you're a fan of Hungarian traditional music.
Yes.
I would recommend two groups.
Okay.
Muzikash and their female singer, Marta Sebastian.
Okay.
And Kayad, which in Romani means black fire.
Excellent.
It is Hungary's favorite Romani group.
I will definitely check that out.
Den of Thieves.
Yes, Den of Thieves.
Let me ask about Den of Thieves.
Of course.
Are your thieves basically in the tradition of Ned Kelly, Dick Turpin, all those good folks, robbed from the rich, gave to the poor, social banditry, that sort of thing?
In the sense that they're trying to make a living, and they come from the underclass and are trying to not starve to death. So, yes, they're working towards social justice in the sense that they're poor people who don't want to starve.
So,
no, these are thieves in the more realistic sense. They steal from whoever has the money.
Yes, in the sense of the clever Hassan from the Arabian Nights.
Indeed, yeah.
Of all the things.
Or Darger and Surplus from Michael Swanwick's recent works.
Oh, I love Dancing with Bears. Those Darger and Surplus are my two favorite original con men and thieves right now. They are just wonderful. Okay, setting. Where is it set?
It is set in a medieval world. This is what some people call vanilla fantasy. I hate that term because it makes it sound so boring.
I'm not familiar with that term.
I am.
I've
heard it.
This is a traditional.
I don't like it either.
Yeah, this is traditional medieval fantasy. The Middle Ages is a period of history that's always fascinated me. I have done an incredible amount of research to try to provide. This obviously it's a fantasy world. It is not Earth, and so it's not going to be an exact replica of England in 1300.
It's not going to be Renaissance Italy or medieval Germany or whatever.
Right. This is my own world, but I have tried to fix some of the errors that I've seen in recent fantasy fiction. I wrote an essay recently, and I said if I read one more fantasy novel where the hero zips up his tunic, pulls on his rubber-soled shoes, and says, "All right, let's roll," I'm going to throw the book across the wall. I've done my absolute level best while maintaining an entertaining book, because that's always the fun balance, of getting the history right in this thing.
How widespread is your world? What I mean by that is, do we go beyond a border? Do we see kingdoms 10 kingdoms away? Do we see rivalries?
Absolutely. We're going to start small.
Do the boots go 7 leagues?
Yeah. This book is going to start small. It takes place in one medieval walled city. The second book is going to branch out into the countryside, and you're going to see the kingdom of that city. And the third book is going to get into the politics between the various countries.
I love this already. Haven't even read a page. One other question. Are you going to have what we would call a backdrop to this world? Do we have a mythology? Now, you said that it's sort of interrelated. Are you going to have stories within stories, a la frame stories, as in the manner of Gregory Frost's Shadow Bridge?
Yeah, there are no frame stories in the books as written, but I'm going to have a lot of extra material. I'm going to have short stories that will show up on my website. I'm going to have side books. I'm going to have prequels and sequels. As long as they let me keep writing these things, this world is real to me in the sense that I could tell you what's going on in any corner of this world at a given time.
What's the name of your medieval walled city, by the way?
It's called the Free City of Ness.
Spell that, please.
N-E-S-S.
Like Elliot.
Exactly.
Or Loch.
Yes.
Yes, more clever readers might notice that the main character's name is Malden, as in Carl Malden, and it's the Free City of Ness, as in Elliot Ness.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple fun
That's
little...
That's untouchable.
A lot of By the way, one last thing. You mentioned authors that you were impressed by. You mentioned Leiber. Of course, I was a big fan of Fafford Gray Mouser. You mentioned Clark Ashton Smith. Were you ever a fan of Lord Dunsany?
Absolutely. I think that Lord Dunsany has done both an incredible service and a great disservice to fantasy fiction.
The King of Elfland's Daughter, my favorite novel.
Absolutely. I think that Dunsany was the guy who really gave us the tools to start what we think of as modern fantasy by allowing us to make up our own mythologies, to say you don't have to be stuck with 4,000 years, 5,000 years of European culture.
You can write. If people can find him, we're talking about old books before. In the late 60s, Lynn Carter, working for Ballantine Books, put out these magnificent series of Masters of Fantasy, and between him and Sprague de Camp, bringing forth all this incredible work, ranging from Robert E. Howard and all that, which A, lit a match under a lot of readers, but B, more importantly, lit a match under writers.
He reissued books like The King of Elfland's Daughter, The Charwoman's Shadow, The Chronicles of Don Rodrigo. I mean, he reissued all the, and he also reissued lots of Dunsany collections like Over the Hills and Far Away and mm-hmm. Tales from Three Hemispheres. Dunsany, of course, as you know, was also a master of the short story.
Yes.
He was, to me, the Frederick Brown of fantasy.
Yes.
If you think about it.
Well, I think Frederick Brown would have probably acknowledged that. It was clearly an evolutionary thing between the two.
And I think he would have been really honored to have someone say that as well.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
To have someone say that Frederick Brown was the Lord Dunsany.
Last question. When is Den of Thieves coming out?
Den of Thieves is out right now.
Oh, it is out. I thought you said they were coming out in the fall, all in the fall.
Well, okay. So
the complete trilogy.
Oh, I see.
The complete trilogy out in the fall. The first book is out now. It's available in bookstores and online. And I believe you can pre-order the second volume, which is called A Thief in the Night.
Thief in the Night and Honor Among Thieves is the third.
Exactly.
So they'll be all out by Christmas.
Indeed. From Voyager.
From Voyager. Thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're on the radio.
Okay.
Turn down your radio, please.
How you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Okay. I just wanted to mention a couple of things about monsters that I just heard. And this is why the monsters was so funny. Monsters don't wear clothes.
Okay.
They don't drive cars.
Uh-huh. No. Some monsters wear sneakers.
Well, let me just finish. They don't wear clothes. They don't drive cars. And when they walk down the street, everybody wants to kill them. And the reason why I think, like, vampires, which have bored the heck out of me ever since I first saw Dracula, I never really did like vampires because they're not really, I guess, scary enough to me. You know, that kind of like, you know, that whole hypnotism thing, I just never really bought it. They have too many superpowers and too many, you know, mirrors and
crosses. Depends on the vampire.
Yeah, so the vampire and the zombie are so popular today is because these are monsters that actually have human faces.
Yes.
And a zombie is a monster that could be you. When you're dead, that's what you look like,
yes.
Right? So we recognize that.
Right.
And I think it's like we have a fascination with death. I mean, you literally see people walking on the street with, like, you know, the skull rings, the skull earrings, the T-shirts. I had a friend who came to the city with a Nosferatu T-shirt. So we're basically, there are people, and in all societies and all facts of time and all that kind of stuff, they worship death.
Yeah, right. but they're also seeking after life, and this is very important, especially with vampires. Not so much zombies, because zombies tend to be brainless unless they're eating. But outside of that, vampires are the continuation of life through a dead person,
yeah,
and that's very important.
Quest for immortality,
it's
which I was going to say something about. But there's also, I had a friend who was into, there was that Roman legend of she, and I was trying to remember the legend. There was like the blue flame. And I don't know if you ever heard of this. It was like the blue and the gold has to do with destiny or something like that. It's like a gold flame and a blue flame, and one will give you immortality, and if you don't have the right frequency, you'll just die. But that there were like two flames of destiny or something, and it's like you had to choose like one or the other.
All right. Well,
you never heard of that?
What I have heard of, and I don't know if this is going to speak to what you're talking about or not, but and it actually appears in Bram Stoker's Dracula, is there's this idea, and it's a folk belief in Romania, that at midnight a blue flame will appear above a cache of buried treasure. And there's this belief that there are these hidden hoards of treasure all over Romania. And if you just look and find these blue flames, that you can actually dig them up and get rich.
Were those supposedly the spirits that were guarding them, or?
I don't think they actually went that far.
Or it just meant fortune or something?
We're talking about folklore, so yeah. I don't know if it ever got into that much detail.
It's just the flame is there, that's it.
Yeah. No, but I also know that on certain, you know, like the color guards of shields of medieval houses and stuff like that, they did have blue and gold symbols.
Well,
I think
all
that
those
like
colors,
predated.
Yeah.
I think like Romans had the same type of flags and symbols too.
Well, absolutely. I think that, you know, the heraldry has always been a huge part of the European tradition. All those colors have their meanings, and in fact, you still see them in today's flags. The red, white, and blue of the American flag. Each of those colors has a specific meaning.
And if anybody goes to camp and they have what they call color team wars, the teams are always the blue and the gold.
Well, wasn't almost red in the flag meant to represent blood that was shed?
Yeah, the sacrifice of the soldiers who fought in the revolution.
I forgot what the blue meant.
Blue is usually fidelity, loyalty. It can be, you know, just
honor,
faith, honor and faith
in the white part was the people who were killing everybody.
Yeah, well,
there
that's
we
a
go.
Good point.
The imperialism, yes.
And you can't have BAI without white guilt.
I believe
there is no such thing as BAI without white guilt. Bite your tongue.
White was meant to represent the morality, the goodness of the country, which, you know. Well,
anyhow, we're
I
a little far
like
field.
Okay,
from
Jim,
front.
I just want to mention one thing, and then I'll get off. I mentioned last time about Callan, you know, the spy show with what's his name, Edward Woodward. They make a cameo appearance in the Alan Moore's 1969. So, just wanted to say that.
Oh, okay, very good, cool.
And it's very brief. I don't know if you are you familiar with Callan, Mr.
Wellington or Chandler?
Chandler Wellington?
Chandler?
No, I'm not.
Okay, well, there's a thief character. The whole thing is that he's a spy. He's a very cynical kind of burnout spy in the 60s. Very stark BBC series with Edward Woodward, and it predates The Equalizer. So
I like everything
the
you've
running
said
thing
so
is
far.
That he press gangs this really kind of, I guess, like semi-moronic, and that's kind of part of the joke, petty thief called Lonely. He's
okay.
Like very streetwise and always getting thrown into jail. He's always like a loser. And so
spell the name
a
of the show
appearance
for me.
In the Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, 1969, which just came out. And I was just like mentioning it. And I'm going like, oh my God, there's a cameo of Callan and Lonely.
Now, how do you spell Callan?
C A L L A N.
Okay.
And there's two series on the BBC. I recommend it. All right. Thanks.
Check that out.
Thanks so much. It sounds like a lot of fun. All righty. Good morning. You're on the radio. Yellow.
I can't believe I'm so lucky. I was giving up. I was going to go upstairs. I'm so glad you were on tonight because I love what you're saying, fantasy.
Well, thank you.
And I do think what you're off. By the way, are you a Wellington going all the way back to Wellington in England?
I am no relation whatsoever to the Duke of Wellington. My ancestors were actually Irish, and they lived on the estates of the Duke of Wellington.
Ah, there's a connection.
Ooh.
You sound so interesting. Well, you know what I like about what you said? You were so bored as a teenager. I think that fantasy and thoughts and dreams come from the very people who begin speaking to us as children, and I think our imaginations just sounds stick in your head for years, words, and even as a little kid, if you just looked at comics that people were reading to you, you immediately began to imagine. I find it so interesting what you were saying. Can I call you Mr. Chandler, too?
You may call me anything you like.
Oh, I love you. You're
Dave
so liberal.
Or David.
Imagine if people like you are amazing. And I'm so glad he has you there. But what I wanted to ask you was, you were saying that you already know the kingdoms that you're going to be mapping out. once you start writing, do you keep changing, or are you inspired to add more and, you know, embellish what you say the next stories are going to be?
Excellent question.
It's a tough balance. It's the hardest thing a writer has to do is decide whether you want to change something. Once you've written it down, it gets so much harder.
You're so smart. I was hoping you would say that.
You know, it's like on television, if they have an actor who wants too much money or something, they replace him with a completely different actor, and they pretend like it's the same person, and they never say a word about it. And people just accept that. It's a long tradition. In books, people go nuts. People go nuts if you change one little thing, or if you didn't get the details exactly straight.
I thought you said he wore the hat this way.
But that's good, because that book and those words are in a person's mind.
Absolutely. And,
yeah.
And I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
No, I know what you're saying.
No, when you paint a picture of the mind's eye, it is so personal, that inner retina, that it is going to be a particular way. And this is why sometimes I object to even great movie adaptations. I mean, Peter Jackson did a fabulous job on Lord of the Rings, but I'm sorry, it destroyed a lot of my mind's eye, and I reread the books over and over again to preserve my personal imagery.
Exactly.
And I've worked hard to maintain that. And that's because of the little details in there. And if, you know, in one scene, Frodo wears the ring on his left side, and the next scene, it's on the right, and there's a continuity problem, nobody cares. But in a book, that's a huge difference.
Can I say one more thing, Jim? When I listen to you two, I think it's the same way in music. When I start hearing Bach and all the music I heard as a child, then you hear an artist such as, who is the one that changed his whole playing? That wonderful fellow that died, Montreal musician, I can't think of his name. But he played Bach so that you...
Oh, Glenn Gould?
That guy.
Yeah.
I'm saying to you, it's the same thing with music. It's the same thing with sounds. It's the same thing with sense. Because, Jim, you were saying about sense. They said that the more things going on when you are young, it makes you remember things because you connect the sound with the smells, with your feelings, with, as your author says, with the imagination.
Absolutely.
So I think we're fantastic beings, and I don't have to say anything more. I just love that you're on again and you're not money-raising, because that makes me sick, but what can you do?
Yeah.
I like you better when you do your shtick, and I'm so pleased to know your author, and I can't wait to read you.
Thank you so much.
I'll let someone else talk.
Thank you so much. I want to speak to what you said, because
you
said something really interesting. You talked about those early childhood images and sense and sounds and so on. And I think that children get told stories all the time. We tell children stories for various reasons, either to just entertain them or to teach them moral lessons or whatever. And I think that is so true that stories are what you take with you into your life. You will always remember those stories you heard as a kid. They will shape who you are. And I think that's one of the wonderful powers of books. I don't think movies really have that same power. I think that, you know, a lot of parents will just park a kid in front of a DVD for 2 hours because they shut up and they just watch the screen and it's free babysitting, and I just wonder if that will ever have the same power as giving a child a book and letting them discover that world at their own pace, in their own way, with their own imagination.
And not only that, what you just said before, when you hear it on the radio, it's exactly as if it were printed. Because your brain remembers who is reading it.
It comes close. It really does.
Right.
Well, really, you have reawakened my wish to be a writer myself, because every time I listen to writers talking to Jim, I get more hope about how to do more. I think it's the most wonderful thing on earth, really. And I think you're so correct. It keeps us hopeful, because we can change the ugly things to what we love and inspire others.
Absolutely. Get to it. Yeah, go get on the word processor or the typewriter or whatever.
Thank
you. Grab a pen, whatever you do, and start writing stories.
Thank you so much.
And let me know when you do.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Okay, let's try to, we've got 5 minutes left, but let's try to sneak in one phone call, one more. Good morning, you're on the radio.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say, you made me think about something Jimmy said about the olfactory, and I was thinking about the olfactorial memory loop, and it's a very strong part of the way we process images, I think, and it works in all different directions, because you mentioned about rereading and being reminded of a smell, and also how it works in the other direction also. You smell something, and it can trigger a memory, an ancient memory, and then one thing links to another.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
It's a wonderful chain reaction.
It turns out that's largely... that is the best way to bring back memories, is smells.
It's through smell, yeah.
That part of your brain that processes smells, that lobe of your brain.
It's a totally intuitive area.
But it's also, it's right in one of the best memory centers of your brain. And so they're not just linked in that sense, but they're physically linked, they're biologically linked. And that's why smells are so important to us.
I imagine dogs never forget anything.
Well,
hydrant around the corner. Yep.
Having had a dog, I can tell you, you think they do, but they don't. I had a dog who got away from me in Central Park, and we were probably 3 miles from our apartment building, and she ran out into the street, and I was terrified that this dog was going to get hit by a car.
Oh,
but a dog can run so much faster than a human being, so I had no chance of catching her. She just kept running and running and running, and I ran until I just couldn't stand up straight, and I was begging people on the street, "Did you see a dog? Did you see a dog?" And I searched around for that dog for hours. Finally, I had to give up. I went back to my apartment building, like I said, about 3 miles away, and the dog was sitting there in the lobby of the apartment
building. Saying, "Where have you been? Where's my food?
Where have you been? You had me so scared."
Oh, boy.
Yeah, dogs have great memories. They're just different from ours.
Amazing. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Reminds me of good night. Reminds me, of course, of the Disney film that they did twice, The Incredible Journey, which was apparently based on something factual.
Yeah, it's, you know, you never know with those things how true it was, but certainly.
Actually, they did. I did at one time read the story upon which it was based. It involved something like 25, 30 miles, wasn't cross country or anything, but it was nevertheless an amazing story.
Right. Yeah.
Didn't need the fictional. Watership Down, I thought, did a wonderful job of fictionalizing of, you know, getting across an entire farm.
And the idea of just how animals are similar to us, but just with different faculties. What I love about that book is that the idea of Tharn and the fear that the rabbits would feel and the supernatural dread.
Yeah, I just found my Richard Adams interview. I'll have to rebroadcast that at some point.
Yeah.
We are eek. 2 minutes away from playing our outro music.
Okay.
So in doing that, we need to mention, A, your website is located, your current website is The Blade...
AncientBlades.com.
Ancient Blades, plural, AncientBlades.com. The first book that is just now in print is Den of Thieves, and under the name David Chandler, spelled like Raymond, but David, Chandler. And you have any number of books in print today under the name Wellington.
And more to come. One question I get asked a lot is whether I've stopped writing horror, whether I've given up on horror under the Wellington name.
And no, the question I haven't had time for is, what are you writing next?
I want to assure people that that's not true. I have my fifth vampire book is coming out next year.
Ah.
Early 2012. Yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about that one, but maybe another time.
Yeah, well.
But I want to assure my fans on both sides that this is adding something to my writing. It is not taking away. And if you liked my horror novels, I think you're going to love this book. Maybe you won't. And if you don't, that's fine.
But if you like good storytelling and fantasy, classic fantasy, this is a great place to go, Den of Thieves.
I hope everybody will enjoy it.
Okay. Next week on this program, Steven Siegel and Genevieve Valentine, among others, to talk about their new book, Geek Wisdom. This coming Tuesday, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings presents Keith DeCandido and Laura Ann Gilman, both wonderful fantasy and science fiction writers, and all kinds of stuff to come in the near future. Lev Grossman will be here also. So do keep tuning in and stay tuned now for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. We're on the air this time. Time before this, we were on the internet only, and so there were no restrictions, were there?
It was fun.
Yeah, it was. Okay, thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week from 1:30 to 3. Thank you, David Chandler and David Wellington.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you, everybody, all the listeners and all the callers. It was a lot of fun.
Great. Good morning.
Join the call, the first interactive newscast. You tell us what's news. I'm John Schumo. Your top stories from NY1.com coming up. For the first time in more than 4 years, more New Yorkers say their state is headed in the right direction, but it depends on what part of the state you live in. A New York One Marist College poll found 46% of New Yorkers surveyed think the state is moving along the right path, while 45% say it's on the wrong course. Here in the city, optimism has fallen the past 3 months. Back in May, more than half of city residents thought the state was on the right track. Now just 44% say it's going the right way. What's the difference?
I ain't giving up.
We soldiers.
I don't care what y'all say.
You never back down.
It only make me stronger when you put me down. Woo! You're doing me a favor when you push me round. Cause every time you knock me down, I get stronger and stronger. Every time you knock me down, I get stronger and stronger.
As a kid I was a star. I tried to raise the bar, but I never had encouragement. It really was bizarre. Everybody used to think me set my goals too far. All the girls that ridicule me when I walk with my guitar. Hey, I wasn't into cars, no inner petty wars. I knew I was a winner who was destined for Mars. But it sucked cause I have all these emotional scars. Hey, everybody thought I would end up behind bars. Nah, a lot of y'all thought I wouldn't make it. A lot of y'all not real and just a fake it.
Turn like me, they yearn for the flag too.
inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the bits cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
And you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM. Listen to here until 5 o'clock when Al Jazeera English comes in.
Feels it's good getting used. Oh, you just keep on you than me. Until you use me up. Until you use me up. My brother sent me right down and he talked to me. That I ought not to